Darling, you sent me. I know you sent me. Darling, you sent me. Honest, you do. Honest, you do. Honest, you do.
We talk about Sam Cooke this hour of the program, who traveled the road from small-time gospel singer to pop star icon. On this day in 1964, there were headlines about the release of 19 white male suspects in the killing of three civil rights workers in rural Mississippi. Also, the second lead was Dr. Martin Luther King's acceptance of the Nobel Peace Prize. It was also on this day that Sam Cooke died a very tragic death, and we'll talk about that as we discuss his life and his music this hour of the program, and we'll hear some Sam Cooke tunes as well. The author of You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke, is our guest this hour of the program, Daniel Wolf, also author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. We'll be welcoming phone calls. I know that many of you listening are probably great fans of Sam Cooke. How could you not be with that voice and the messages? And his life story is pretty compelling. 800-486-8655 is our number. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. And our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Daniel. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me, Kathleen.
Every time I hear that voice, it is so gorgeous, isn't it? It is so smooth. It's just beautiful. The man could sing.
The man could sing and write music and run a business and a bunch of other stuff.
Mm-hmm. When I think about the song that we played at the top here, A Change Is Gonna Come, I think about him as a Southern performer. I forget that he spent most of his life really in the Chicago area where he developed his talent. But if you could, I think in the book you talk about the number of big-time names who have come from that little town in Mississippi where he was born.
Clarksdale, Mississippi is the center of the blues in a lot of ways, and it was partly because, you know, it's in the Delta, so there were an awful lot of people down there working at jobs that didn't pay very well and looking for a way out. And so whether it was Muddy Waters or Sam Cooke or others, they tended to come to Clarksdale as the first stop on a migration that ended up most often in Chicago or sometimes Detroit.
Mm-hmm. And his dad was a preacher, Sam's dad?
Yeah, born-again holiness preacher. A very good one, apparently.
And was Sam singing in his dad's church when he was just a young lad?
Sam, as far as I can tell, Sam was singing from almost birth. his father told me a story about him sitting in the backyard as a, I think, 3 or 4 year old, setting up under a pecan tree, setting up little sticks and pretending they were audience and singing to them.
So
he loved it, and he grew up in music, which was mostly the church. One of the things about the Holiness Church, as a sort of kind of radical offshoot of the Baptist Church, was that it emphasized music and any kind of music. So where a Baptist service might be a little more controlled and singing from a hymnal or whatever, anything went at a holiness service, and there was constant music in his life.
We're going to play a little bit of Garment here in a moment. If you could set it up for us, this is with his early band, Touch the Hem of His Garment, Sam,
right,
with his band, the Soul Stirrers. Tell me about that group.
Well, the Soul Stirrers were one of the two or three greatest black gospel quartets, both before and after World War II. They had an astonishing lead singer called R.H. Harris, and they were a very innovative group, and Harris decided to retire sort of at the peak of their popularity in the early 50s, and of all the people they could have picked, they picked a teenager called Sam Cooke, who had this wonderful voice, not, I'm going to say this, your listeners will be horrified, not as good a voice as R.H. Harris, who had this tremendous voice. But Sam had this way of putting over a song that the older guys in the gospel quartet couldn't believe. Suddenly there were teenage girls wanting to come to gospel service.
Oh, that'll do it.
They hadn't seen that before. So this is a song he wrote that I think, you know, gives a real good example of how he could tell a story both lyrically and then in singing the song and putting it over.
And While she was pushing her way through, someone asked her, what are you trying to do? She said, if I could just touch the hem of his garment, I know I'll be made whole. She cried, oh.
Did Sam write that?
Yeah. Yeah, and did that yodel that became famous, that funny little quaver in his voice that was, you know, as in You Send Me, as in the pop stuff, too. I'm prejudiced, Kathleen, but I think his best singing may be on his gospel stuff. It's got more range. It can get rougher. He was being very careful often with the rock and roll songs we love. Sounds like, you know, the opposite of what you'd think. But gospel was kind of no holds barred, and rock and roll, he was walking, among other things, a racial line to make sure that he didn't seem too presumptuous and too out there.
Mm-hmm. So he was really a prolific songwriter. He was a triple threat guy, right?
Yeah, he loved writing, and he as far as I can tell, he had a trick, which is he'd spend a lot of time working on it late at night and getting a song perfect. And then it'd come a recording session. They'd say, well, we need another cut. Sam said, well, I'll just write one now.
Ah.
And it'd pull out this song he'd been working on for a long time and go, is this okay? You know, and it looked miraculous.
It's amazing that he was only, what, 19 in that song that we just heard?
Mm-hmm.
He sounds much
older.
That's
right, but he'd been singing probably for, you know, 10 years professionally at 19. He went out with his brothers and sisters in a little group called the Singing Children. And then he was with another gospel group called the Highway QCs. So right through high school he sang. He was not as seasoned as the rest of the Soul Stirrers, but had a bunch of experience.
Mm-hmm. And tell us a little bit about those teenage years. He wound up, it's a fascinating story, in prison for some period of time. I can't imagine that would happen today over a morals charge. What's the story?
Yeah, he had a girlfriend who he showed what now would probably not even be called pornography, but sort of a racy book. And a littler kid in the house got hold of it somehow. The story is a little complicated, but he ended up spending 90 days in the Cook County Jail, which was not a place anybody wanted to be, and certainly not a young black man. And this from a family, you know, where, as you said, his father was a minister, and they were very you know, respected in the community. So it was a little break with what was expected of him. And you know, you can see it as a sort of foreshadowing of him eventually breaking from gospel music altogether.
Mm-hmm. Was it a felony charge that dogged him for his life?
No, not that I know of. I think it was they didn't have a lawyer. They, you know, didn't, they being Chicago police, didn't care too much about the black population. And the easiest thing to do is to spend 90 days in jail.
Hmm.
He never talked about it much again, but, you know, that happened. And, you know, it's part of his personality. It's odd, Kathleen, because we know him as such a clean-cut.
Yes.
He was very careful to be a clean-cut Christian type, and he was some of that, but he had a bunch of troubles in his background that was maybe the earliest example.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned, Daniel, that you think his best singing is with his gospel song, so that makes us want to play another. This is Sam Cooke with the Soul Stirrers in 57 as well. Were you there?
Ask them, were you there? Were they
When did he make the decision, and I'm wondering if the family welcomed this decision or protested it, to move into the realm of pop music, Daniel?
He went and asked his father. It was a sort of repeat. When the Highway QCs were finishing up and the Soul Stirrers wanted him, he went to his father, and his father said, yeah, you should make the jump to this bigger group, because part of what you're trying to do here is earn a living. And there's nothing wrong with that. His father worked in the steel mills, did all kinds of manual labor, was a union guy. And he liked it. His son was getting ahead. So when he came then in, I guess, 55, 56, whenever it was, and said, I'm thinking of switching to pop music, He checked with his father, and where you might think that a minister would say, absolutely not, it's the devil's music, Reverend Cook said, you know, if that's how you can earn a living and get ahead, absolutely you should do it, as long as you stay a good Christian in your heart.
And so what was the song that really moved him to the forefront of everybody's minds and hearts and feet?
The song was You Send Me. There's a sort of a story I like about it, which is when I wrote my book, one of my collaborators was Cliff White, who was Sam's guitar player.
Oh.
And Sam brought him You Send Me to teach him the chord changes so they could record a little demo of it. And Cliff sat down with me and he said, so this kid comes to me with this song and it says, You Send Me. And then it keeps saying, You Send Me, over and over again. And then it comes to the chorus and it starts again saying, You Thrill Me. And it just keeps saying that. And I thought, this song is going nowhere. This is absolutely awful. And he was with Specialty Records, who had done the gospel stuff with the Soul Stirrers. And when he left there to do this pop music, both the guy at his new label and the guy at Specialty dismissed You Send Me as, you know, trivial, nothing important. It was a huge hit. It made his career. And it's not only, as you say, this great voice and this great approach, but there's something addictive about that song. It's hard to get out of your head in a very sweet way.
Mm-hmm. And here it is.
Darling, you send me. Honest, you do. Whoa, you thrill me. I know you thrill me. Darling, you thrill me. Honest, you do.
Sam Cooke in his biggest hit, You Send Me. We welcome phone calls for our guest, Daniel Wolfe, who's the author of You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke. Today is the anniversary of the death, and it was a tragic death. We'll talk about that later this hour of soul legend Sam Cooke. We're celebrating his music and his legacy. Our phone number is 800-486-8. I feel like I need to talk to the song. 800-486-8655. This is the Ideas Network.
Send me, honest you do. Don't know much about history. Don't know much biology. Don't know much about a science book. Don't know much about the French I took. But I do know that I love you. If you love me too, what a wonderful world this would be.
Sam Cooke and What a Wonderful World. That had to have been a big hit. I know almost all the words to that song all these years later, Daniel.
It's true. It was covered, too, by, I think, James Taylor and Carly Simon.
Oh, sure.
So, you know, that's one of the things. These songs have lasted, which, you know, isn't true of all of the stuff from that era. They're well put together and, as I said, very catchy. Hard to forget.
Yeah, it is. You write early in your book that Sam Cooke lived his life at the center of cultural change. He was there when gospel music's coded message of hope and rebellion bloomed into the civil rights movement. Can you talk a little bit more about that for those people, and some are listening, who weren't alive during that time? What was the cultural change he was at the center of?
Well, you know, it's one of the big reasons I wrote the book was to try to focus in on that. And we've talked a little bit about him coming out of the gospel world. And the gospel world was a kind of ghetto, kind of musical ghetto, in that it mostly had black listeners. It was mostly performed in black churches. While the group sold records, it was a segregated audience, essentially. And what happened, his father, Sam's father, as I said, came out of Clarksdale and went north, and with him came hundreds of thousands of others. And there began a kind of de facto integration of the culture, among other things. Every once in a while, I sort of stop and look and try to figure out how rock and roll happened, that this thing exploded in the 50s. And it seems very unlikely, among other things, that 10% of the population, the black population, had such an effect on the other 90 in terms of this music. And I think part of that was this great influx into the cities and this kind of pent-up creativity that was there. And Sam, in a lot of ways, embodies it. Lots of people crossed over from gospel into rock and roll after Sam, not many before him. So Della Reese and Lou Rawls and Marvin Gaye sang some gospel, a bunch of people did. But he was the star that kind of crossed over, and his example was this stuff that we've been doing, this great stuff for ourselves, should and could be mainstream. And I think that was a huge shift in America.
Mm-hmm. And was it difficult, being one of the first to do this as a black performer, to make that change? Did he suffer discrimination, Daniel?
Yeah, it was very hard, I think, on a number of levels. For one thing, there's still gospel people I talk to, gospel fans, who don't forgive him because they think he's sold out to the devil's music.
Oh.
So there's that side of it. On the other side of it, there are a couple things. One is, you listen to You Send Me, or What a Wonderful World This Could Be, and compare it to the gospel music, and as I said earlier, Sam is walking a very thin line. He's charming and cute, and he was incredibly handsome and sexy, but he was reining that in a little,
mm-hmm.
more than a little. So he was making sure that he wasn't seen as a danger or a threat.
Hmm.
At the same time, as he toured, he kept running into this situation where the audience would be segregated, or he couldn't stay in the motel with the rest of the acts that were on the bill. And the kind of things you hear about, he ran into all the time, and his touring coincided with the civil rights movement coming forward, and he was very involved in that.
And we'll talk more about that. We have a couple clips of Sam Cooke being interviewed. One of his being interviewed, and then another clip of him with Muhammad Ali, who I think was known as Cassius Clay back in those days. This is Sam Cooke interviewed by Dick Clark, who talks about, Sam does, the key to his songwriting.
Here's a man whose career so far is about 6 years old in this field, not counting what went on before. What's the secret?
I think the secret is really observation, Dick.
What do you mean?
Well, if you observe what's going on and try to figure out how people are thinking and determine the times of your day, I think you can always write something that the people will understand.
And did he do that?
Yeah. I mean, you know, everybody likes to cha-cha-cha. It was him looking around. Sam Cooke couldn't dance a lick.
Really?
He had two left feet. he was famous for it, and his family and friends used to kid him. But he looked around, and there was a cha-cha craze. And he went, no, wait a second, there's got to be a way I can do this. He was a smart businessman, calculating in his own way, and, as he says, they're observant.
Could he twist?
Could he twist? No.
He couldn't
stood
twist
there.
Either. Really? Twisting
no,
is easy.
No, he stood there. He snapped his fingers. If you see the few clips of him live, he snapped his fingers, and he was a graceful man, but he was not a dancer.
Huh. Well, twisting, it makes us want to twist. Here's a little bit of, you'll know this song, Twisting the Night Away.
Let me tell you about a place somewhere up in New York way, where the people are so gay, twisting the night away. Here they have a lot of fun, putting trouble on the run. Man, you find the old and young, twisting the night away.
Sam Cooke, Twisting the Night Away. We're talking about Sam Cooke this hour on the Ideas Network with Daniel Wolfe, who's written a really absorbing book about him. You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke, and we're welcoming phone calls. The conversation today, because this is the anniversary of his tragic and rather violent death. We go to phone calls, 800-486-8655 is our number. Scott in La Crosse. Do you know how to twist, Scott?
Nobody wants to see that. No, I was probably about as graceful as the Sam Cooke as the dancer. I got legendary for that. I do have a Sam Cooke story. I was a freshman in college at Colorado State University, and we were a very white school. And in my dorm, we had exactly one black guy, and he was a football player from the South on the Colorado State football team, obviously. And we're all in the common room, a bunch of us just having, you know, the usual bull session that night. And George, our football player, and of course, you know, we're all kind of we're all young and immortal, of course, and we're all kind of in awe of, you know, our one jock among us. And he comes into the common room and just walks quietly over to one of the chairs and is just muttering, "It's a shame, man. It's a damn shame." And then he sits down in the corner and just starts softly crying. And we're all going, "George, what's the matter? What's, you know?" And then one of our dorm mates walks in just then and says, "Hey, did you guys hear? Sam Cooke died." Mm-hmm. We're all going, "Oh, my Lord." So it was quite a memorable evening for, you know, like I say, an immortal youngster, a little wake-up call for the realities of life.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Scott, for calling. And you start your book with that death because it remains controversial. What happened to him? It's a horrible story, and it's hard to believe that Sam Cooke would have come to that end. We may as well talk about it now.
Well, for one thing, Scott's situation was duplicated all across the country, which was there were a lot of fans, and they didn't. I don't know if Scott's right. They expected him to live forever, but they certainly didn't expect for him to die this way. Which he was found in a motel in a seedy part of L.A. wearing a coat and nothing else, and the owner of the motel, a African-American woman, said he'd tried to attack her and had shot him in self-defense. He had arrived at the motel with a woman who a few months later would be convicted of prostitution. It was not the Sam Cooke people saw on the Dick Clark Show.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was a big source of the controversy. They couldn't believe that this guy would end up in that situation. I spent a lot of time researching his death and hired a private detective actually to try to help out.
Really?
Yeah. And, you know, at the end of the day, it doesn't clear up very well. What seemed obvious to me was that nobody really wanted to get to the bottom of it particularly. Not that there was necessarily a conspiracy, but his record label RCA was busy selling records. They had no real interest. His wife had all kinds of other issues that she didn't want to have looked into. His business manager was essentially steered away from it and wasn't that interested in pursuing it. And the people who, his close friends, while they tried to get at the bottom of it, finally couldn't get anywhere and couldn't figure out what had happened. It's, you know, it is conceivable that Sam Cooke, like all of us, had some failings, mm-hmm. and in this case, he was in the wrong place at the wrong time. I think at the end of the day, that makes more sense to me than the other theories, which are he was hit by the mob or other people close to him had him killed. That doesn't add up.
But it doesn't add up that the woman would kill him, that he would attack somebody, unless he a drug user, or it's hard to imagine.
No, I don't think he was a drug user. He had some alcohol in his body, but it was, you know, enough just to be legally drunk, I think, but not, you know, a whole lot. The woman he'd come with had taken his clothes, which included his wallet.
Uh-huh.
And there at least were some people who said he had quite a lot of money in that wallet, like $1,000, which in 1964 was even more than $1,000 now.
Right.
It was near Christmas and he'd been doing some shopping and he liked to carry money around anyway. It could have been that rage. It could have been the hour of the night. He could have just been asserting that, wait a second, I'm Sam Cooke. This can't happen to me. Yeah, it's confusing. That's mm-hmm. part of why the controversy continues.
How did the press report the news of his death, Daniel?
Well, the L.A. police, first of all, had no idea who he was and essentially dismissed it as another ghetto shooting and didn't care. And the next day, started seeing people show up at this motel to essentially sit vigil and thought, wait a second. And the black press immediately had banner headlines. And mainstream press pretty soon featured it because he was a very popular artist. The black press, though, really pursued it. The Chicago Defender ran a whole series about it and tried to figure out what had happened. And, you know, I still, I don't know if your listeners out there are among them, but I still run into people who get me in a corner and say, okay, now let's talk this through. What really happened here? It was.
I'm sure you do.
Yeah, it's a little like the Kennedy assassination for some people, you know?
Right.
This guy wasn't supposed to die. He was too young. He was too great. So right. There must be more to it than we're being told.
Hmm. He was way too young. He was way
too 33.
Young. 33 years old. Let's listen to a little more of his music, and then we'll go to more phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tell me about the origins of this Chain Gang song, which I think was his second biggest hit ever. Why this song, Daniel?
Well, Chain Gang to me is like a great example of the conflict Sam was in, which is that it came from him driving around in the South touring and seeing a chain gang.
Mm.
And when he went in and recorded it, he wanted the sound. He fiddled and fiddled to try to get a sound. This great thump you'll hear on it is some of it is him hitting a leather chair with something heavy to try to get the right oomph of guys hitting a hammer. Some of it's banging the bottom of a mic stand with something metal. At the same time, he says, this is the sound of the chain gang. It clearly isn't. It's a pop song, and it's all lightened up and made palatable to his teenage audience. But beneath that veneer is essentially the talk of slavery and of how black people have been treated in the country.
That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang. That's the sound of the men working on the chain gang.
As I listen to that song, it is hard for me to imagine it becoming a hit, isn't it? I mean, it's interesting that he was able to accomplish that kind of catchy tune, but if you've seen one of those chain gangs, it stays in your mind for a long period
of catchy,
time.
Yeah, it's the catchy tune and the great voices, you say, that wins
right.
you over. It's only when you think about it a little and go, wait a second.
Mm-hmm.
You know, this isn't something I should be Lindy hopping to.
Right.
This is
right.
about a chain gang, you know. And those are the contradictions, right? That's the what he had to thread through to become a success, which is he wanted to reflect his black experience, but he wanted to do it in a way that he could sell it to a teenage white audience.
What a mission. What a mission.
Yeah.
Let's go to Sandra in Greendale, another caller. Hi, Sandra. Hello, Sandra.
Hi.
Hi.
I can barely hear you.
Well, we hear you. Go right ahead.
You know what? I'm just thinking about the beginning with Elvis, Michael Jackson, Marvin Gaye, and Sam Cooke, and a lot of people that really in the church, they were very opposed to them leaving, and the connection is. That I've observed is this downward spiral. You know, they reached this, you know, fame that sometimes I don't think they can even handle. They come from small beginnings and they become, you know, these fabulous stars and all this talent. And at the end, it's sad.
Daniel.
Well, you know, Sandra has a point. I mean, the other people that comes to mind as she talks are Richard Nixon and Bill Clinton.
Ah.
I think the dangers of fame and power are there for anybody,
mm-hmm.
kind of. Certainly these were working class and poor people, a lot of them who started rock and roll. And there was a lot of money and temptation around. There's no question about that. you know, one of the things that I remember, I think Bruce Springsteen said when John Lennon was shot, was that part of his sadness was not only losing this talent, but here was one of the few people who could show us how to grow up as a rock and roll star. And it hadn't really happened. You know, Elvis died young. Chuck Berry grew up. Chuck Berry is still with us and you know, is a wise and good man who's still doing his job. But there it was rare because it was high atmosphere, high altitude living, and it was hard to survive it, I think.
Yeah. Well, I guess it's up to Paul McCartney and the Rolling Stones. And
there you go.
Yeah. And when you talk about money, the part of your book, I love people who are generous, and you write that Sam Cooke loved money, but he also loved to give people money.
Well, his circle was among people who didn't have money.
Mm-hmm.
And if he could, you know, it's like Elvis. If he could get them a car, if he could help them with the rent, if he could just hand them a $100 bill,
mm-hmm.
he felt great about it, and he did it a lot. And, you know, Sam had, one of the things I think that helped him so much was he had these older gospel guys who were 50 and 60 to his 30 years old, who were advising him and helping him. And they kind of steered him through the business world of music more than a lot of young stars had. And so he ended up starting his own label, and he ended up with his own publishing for his music, which was really rare in those days. Very sensible about that. But they would be horrified when some bum on the street would come up and Sam would say, here, have this, and give him a big, big bill. They'd think, no, you can't do that. And he'd say, oh, you know, I'm making lots of money.
Why not? Right. Why not? We have a little bit of a clip of him with Cassius Clay, Muhammad Ali. Were they buddies?
Mm-hmm. Sam was interested. I mean, everyone was interested in Cassius Clay. But Sam was also interested in the Black Muslim movement and was very sort of thoughtful, political. He didn't, again, it's one of those lines that was hard to cross, and I think he admired that Cassius Clay had actually the courage of his convictions to come out and, say he was a Muslim and say he was against the war. One of the sadnesses about Sam's life getting cut short is you don't know where that would have gone. But he also just loved Cassius Clay as a figure and a smart, funny man.
Mm-hmm. Sam Cooke with Muhammad Ali in 1964. This is on Harry Carpenter's BBC show.
This is Sam Cooke. As you can see, like me, he's awful pretty. And we are here now working on a record called The Gang's All Here.
Would you like to give us a preview of this disc?
Let's
give him a preview.
We'll do a lot better if we had the music here with us.
I mean, we're going to do it.
We'll try now.
Hey, the gang's all here, join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here, we're gonna swing as one.
Do it again now.
Hey, the gang's all here, join in the fun. Hey, the gang's all here, we're gonna swing as one.
Yeah. How you like that?
How right, you like that? Yourself. That's great, isn't it, Daniel?
Yeah, there's Sam as the producer, helping Ali through a song. You know, when Ali won his championship fight down in Miami, Sam Cooke was in the audience, and he kind of stopped everything to say, I'm the greatest fighter in the world, and here's the greatest singer in the world. Interesting. They were buddies.
And we both have pretty faces.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Jim in Mequon writes, please ask Daniel about the resurrecting of Sam's voice on the recent Les Paul American-made album.
I don't know about that. I'll have to.
I don't either.
Write back in and tell me more.
All right, Jim, write us or call us. Jim in Mequon, a call to you. Tell us more. Let's go to Tim in Stevens Point. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I just want to comment on the what we call the Black Experience back in the late '60s. A bunch of very poor college kids they were sort of associated with the Methodist Church, went down to Oxford, Mississippi, and I can just see like Sam Cooke back in Clarksdale, if he had the same experience like that, what we had in Oxford, Mississippi. I mean, there's one place in the whole city where the blacks were allowed to take money. I mean, the family where we were staying, this was back in '69, 70, after, you know, it was 5 years after the Civil Rights Act, and there was one person in the whole, or one place in the whole city where the blacks were allowed to take money, like the family we stayed with, the guy, he worked at a gas station, and he would come out and check the hood, and under the hood, and fill gas in. As soon as it was time like that, then the white guy would come out and take your money. And this was the capital of Mississippi. And we went around with kids our age and a little younger, and we went to a white movie house, and they thought that was just, you know, they were looking for somebody to, you know, arrest them or something like that, because they had their group, and we had our, or we white stayed in theirs. And then we went out to the, what they call African Methodist Episcopal Church, and what you might call holy rollers, and I didn't experience, but one of our group did, where they'd just kind of roll down the aisle to the music, and screaming and hollering, rolling around, and as if possessed, and plus, they, you know, like most churches, they had the pages to the hymns on the front, and we tried to find that, never did. They would just, it was just totally different, the experience like that, where they'd stop and they'd start, they'd sing a verse, they'd sing three verses. You never knew where they were or what they, but it was all kind of spontaneous, you know, just totally different.
Right, very spontaneous. Tim, thanks very much for the call. Is that Cook's tradition as well, that kind of cultural experience?
Sure, and you know, what Tim's describing, I think what might help his viewers is if they were called on to go into that black Mississippi culture and perform and sing, and that was going to be the main source of their income. That's exactly the flip that Sam did going the other way. They were that, Tim's sort of amazement at this culture and how different it could be but in the same country,
mm-hmm.
was Sam's experience of the white culture in a lot of cases. And it was an enormous crossing over that happened, and it had to be done very, very carefully. And you know, it's like diplomacy. You had to thread the needle, as I said.
Mm-hmm. And that's a good choice of words. It is a crossing over, a crossing over. Well, we're speaking this hour of the program with Daniel Wolfe. Daniel is the author of "You Send Me: The Life and Times of Sam Cooke." Daniel is also the author of The Fight for Home, How Parts of New Orleans Came Back. His book on Sam Cooke is really interesting, and we're talking today partially just as a reason to play some Sam Cooke music and talk about his place in history, but also on the anniversary of his death, December 11, 1964. More phone calls. Like to join us? We'd like to hear from you. 800-486-8655 is the number.
And the living is easy. Fish are jumping. And cotton is high. Your dad is.
R. Kelly covering Bring It On Home to Me. He was singing on the British TV show later with Jules Holland, 2011. The songs, as you were saying earlier, Daniel, have long lives, don't they?
Yeah, indeed. I mean, there's a Amy Winehouse cover of Cupid. A Change Is Gonna Come is a song that lots of people sing. Rod Stewart did a version of You Send Me.
Mm-hmm.
We talked about James Taylor earlier. Yeah, the songs have lasted. You know, I was thinking, Kathleen, part of our earlier conversation about how you grow up as a rock and roller, most of the guys who began it were told and believed that this was going to be 2 or 3 years at the most, that this wasn't a career, this was a flash in the pan. It's a little hard for people now, excuse me, to understand that there was no notion that this was going to keep going. And earlier you played Sam singing Old Man River. Sam's idea of how to make this last was to be Nat King Cole, was to be a middle-of-the-road sort of crooner eventually, because he couldn't believe he could keep appealing to a teen audience or that rock and roll would continue to pay the way it had. So it was a brand new field. It was a new adventure to try to figure out how you went forward with this.
Hmm. Well, he would have to have learned how to dance, right?
Well, I don't know. I don't think Frank Sinatra danced very
That's
well.
True. There's nothing wrong with an Nat King Cole either. Oh, man, I could listen to him. I could really listen to him. You mentioned Amy Winehouse. Let's play another cover. This is Amy Winehouse covering Cupid. This is on the 2007 album, Back in Black.
Cupid, drop back your ball.
Daniel Wolfe is our guest. He's the author of You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke. Let's go to more phone calls. You can join us at 800-486-8655. Joe in Madison, hi.
Hi. Thank you for the show, and I really appreciate the clip of Sam Cooke and Cassius Clay as he was
Wasn't
called.
Wasn't that fun?
It was just wonderful.
Yeah, it was fun.
And I want to ask a question, because I think of other singers who embodied sort of the same mixture of protest and hope and love, and the Impressions come to mind as sort of a similar kind of energy from that time. And I wonder if Sam, if Sam Cooke, had a friendship with Curtis Mayfield, or if he had any kind of friendships with Otis Redding, who covered The Change Is Going to Come.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any of those relationships at all?
Yeah. Thank you for calling, Joe. Because the as it was known, Chitlin' Circuit, which is the tour that black people musicians made in those days, was still mighty segregated. Everybody kind of knew everybody else. So Jerry Butler, Curtis Mayfield's friends, was good friends with Sam Cooke. Otis was younger and came on later, but Otis in a lot of ways modeled himself on Sam Cooke. And when the Monterey Pop Festival happened, which was done, organized in part by Herb Alpert and Lou Adler, who were Sam's buddies. They brought Otis in, Lou Adler told me, as kind of the Sam Cooke, since Sam Cooke was dead. And Monterey was really the moment when Otis crossed over to a white audience. I mean, there's that stuff. He had an enormous influence. Marvin Gaye, whose Sam Cooke's original name had no E on the end of it. That was his sort of nod to being a star somehow. He put an E on Cook. Marvin Gaye had no E on the end of Gay, and as a tribute to Sam, people say, put an E on the end of his name, too.
Oh, I didn't know that.
He was an enormous influence on Smokey Robinson. Aretha Franklin, as much as said, she was in love with him. And there are great pictures of Aretha as a teenager with Sam as not much older than a teenager. And they knew each other from the gospel world. And Sam was the guy, again, who led the way into the pop music field, into rock and roll, where she said, maybe I can do this too.
Hmm. We're going to end the show with one of my favorite songs of his that you can't play enough. But I'm interested in when he heard Blowin' in the Wind, you talk about it catching his attention and a business sense in him. And I'm wondering how much was a business sense and how much was a sense, a political sense, a sense that he wanted change in the country, told him that there was potential in that song and thus Change Is Going to Come happened, which has been used politically for a long time, and we'll end the show with that. But was that in his heart as well? What was he stirred by the Dylan song, by the words of the song?
I think it's a combination. It's that you could actually, Peter, Paul, and Mary actually had a hit with Blowing in the Wind.
Mm-hmm.
And Sam Cooke, who had looked at, as we've talked about, Cha-Cha and other things, went, here's an opening. What's more, the sort of focus of what we've talked about for an hour, this black experience that he had kind of to carefully infuse into his music, here was a big opening, apparently, to tell the truth. And his friends talked about how A Change Is Going to Come, Scared Sam. He'd written it, but he was scared about coming out and actually speaking about his experience.
Really?
And revealing a side of him that he'd kept quiet, mostly. And you can sort of hear it in the song. It's this release. It's, you know, I think his greatest pop song. And it's starting him back. It's such a shame he died right after it was released. It's starting him back also into the kind of gospel terrain. It's almost a gospel song.
Hmm. What are his other greatest songs in your mind?
Oh, Bring It On Home to me is a pretty wonderful
song.
Yes,
it is a wonderful song.
There are a string of, I really recommend folks getting to the gospel music if they can. There's a collection of them that I actually got a Grammy nomination for writing the notes for. It's just a wonderful collection of music. And, there's very little he sang that didn't end up sounding wonderful. He had that way of putting a song over. But certainly A Change Is Going to Come is one of the greatest.
And do you remember, Daniel, the time in your life when you first heard him and knew that you were hearing an extraordinary voice?
I had an older sister. And my older sister loved Sam Cooke. And I didn't get, you know, I'm younger than this, so he was gone by the time I hit my teenage years and was paying attention, so it was retro of me to like him. But the older sister said, yes, you know, Smokey Robinson and the Miracles are good, but do you want to hear something great? And would put a Sam Cooke LP, I can picture it, on our home stereo. And that's how I heard him.
It's wonderful. Nothing like an older sister to guide you, right?
There you go.
Yeah. Are you working on any other musicians right now?
I'm sort of circling some. I'm hesitant to talk about it, but I'm hoping, yeah, to write some more music stuff in the near future.
Well, you should. You're very good at it, and
I appreciated
the book. This particular book is an older book before people run to the bookstore. Can you get it in the bookstore?
You can get it on Amazon for sure, because there's a British edition, as is often the case with soul music. It seems like people outside the country are more appreciative than in. But we'll get it republished here soon, I hope.
Yeah, please do. Thank you. What a wonderful hour. Thanks, Daniel.
Thanks very much, Kathy.
Daniel Wolfe, the book is You Send Me, The Life and Times of Sam Cooke. Legendary soul singer, died tragically on this day in 1964. Thanks to Brett Jaspers and Rhonda Fanning, who produced this program. We're going to end with, I think it's his best song ever. What a song. Change Is Gonna Come, Sam Cooke.
Change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. It's been too hard living, but I'm afraid to die. Beyond the sky, it's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. I go to the movie and I go downtown. Somebody keep telling me don't hang around. It's been a long time coming, but I know a change gonna come. Oh, yes, it will. Then I go to my brother and I say, brother, help me please. But he winds up knocking me back down on my knees. Oh, there have been times that I thought I couldn't last. It's been a long
but I know.